Today's program has been brought to you by Clarkson Potter Publishers, the only dedicated lifestyle group within Random House. Potter invites readers to live well. We seek tastemakers, visionaries, and rising stars and partner them to craft books and products that define their brand while engaging, entertaining, and instructing their audience.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
You're listening to After the Jump. I'm Grace Bonney, your host, and today we're coming to you live from Roberto's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You can listen to After the Jump every Monday at noon on heritageradionetwork.org or download the podcast on iTunes. Today, my guest is Dylan Thuris, co-founder of Atlas Obscura, a compendium of the world's wonders, curiosities, and esoterica. Also, just the coolest guidebook that exists on the internet, I think. So, Dylan, thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Grace. It's great to be here.
So, I want to sort of talk to people a little bit about what Atlas Obscura actually is, because I really do think it is like the coolest travel website that exists in a community that actually already has, I think, some cool guide stuff out there. What you guys are doing is completely different and curated in such an interesting way. Tell people a little bit about what Atlas Obscura is.
Right. So Atlas Obscura, it started 3 years ago, sort of as a personal passion project. I found both me and my co-founder, Josh, really gravitate towards travel to unusual places, small museums, outsider art projects, anything that sort of has a great story. And we found that we couldn't find the kinds of resources that we wanted to find these places. And when we did find books about it, they were sort of written in this kind of wacky, like, isn't this crazy? and it was unfortunate because some of these things are really fascinating and deserve a certain amount of respect and appreciation for really how interesting and unusual they are. So we started compiling this for ourselves, and we realized at a certain point that the only way we were going to make this a real useful tool resource is to open it up and let other people send stuff in. So how it works is basically, it's crowd-generated. People send in crazy places they've been, a weird museum they stumbled upon. And it's funny when you talk to people about this, they always have that place. They're like, you know, there is this one, like, in my hometown, there was this one weird, you know, place or this crazy house. So they send that in, and we have a team of editors who fact-checks it, make sure it's still there and all that kind of stuff. And then we put it up. So it's a really fun process, and it's amazing to see the stuff that comes in.
That's great. I love that the fact that you're using user-generated content, because I think that's one of the best ways to sort of discover something truly weird. I think most like guidebooks you get when they talk about something weird or interesting, it's not actually weird or interesting. It tends to be something that's just kind of like slightly off of the mainstream path. But right. I love the first time I read your site, there's an intro line to Atlas Obscura that says that if you're interested in guides that have to do with glass flowers, books bound in human skin, or gigantic flaming holes in the ground, like, this is the place for you.
It is. If those are your areas of interest, then that's definitely right.
And that's fantastic. So tell me about some of the more interesting reader submissions that you guys have gotten.
So we, you know, once in a while, we'll get something that completely knocks our socks off. And that's always an exciting day. I mean, every single one is great, but one that always jumps to my mind is, I guess about a year and a half ago, we got a submission from a guy who ran a small like bed and breakfast type thing in India, in the rainiest part of India, Cherrapunji. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. and what he wrote us about was these living root bridges where the locals, and this has been going on for 100 years or more than that, but they build a sort of a small structure. And over 15 years, they let the roots of two trees grow together until they're intertwined. And then they take the structure away. And then over the next 50 years, this thing grows into a giant living bridge. And there's, you know, a couple where it's two bridges, one on top of the other, sort of like a double-decker thing. But there was basically nothing on the internet about this when we got this. So we sort of started digging, and we were able to find some, you know, other evidence. We were able to, like, get in touch. Yeah. And so we got the chance to sort of break this story about these root bridges, and that was really exciting because I found it completely fascinating and totally amazing, this sort of living architecture. So
I love that things like that still exist outside of the internet for a while. Yeah. I mean, it's hard because you kind of assume that everything's been discovered at this point. It feels like there's a blog for every obscure travel thing that you'd like to do, but I love that you're still stumbling on these things. How do you actually go about verifying or like getting the details for things like this? They don't exist online yet.
It really depends. It can be tough. I mean, by the nature of some of the submissions we get, it can be really hard to track down. Like, okay,
have you ever had something be completely false?
Yeah. No, well, we've never had stuff be we don't, you know, at the possibility of inviting it.
Yeah.
We don't get a lot of people just putting in like crazy stuff they make up. What we will get sometimes is something that's like, say it's some guy's crazy art project that he did in a small town in like Spain, and he's dead. It's really hard to figure, you know, it's like, it can be really hard to track down someone to be like, can you go there and like see what's going on with this and find out any information you can. So once in a while we run into a dead end, but usually we're able to find something. Usually we're able to find some kind of other, you know, either whether it's in a book or we can call someone, like we can find the nearest town, call someone and like muddle through some terrible, you know, Spanish or find someone who speaks the language and figure it out. So
tell me a little bit about kind of the structure of Atlas Obscura in terms of like your ground team. How many of you are working there and how does everybody's job sort of come together?
Yeah, so we're in the same way our community is kind of this like far flung set of, you know, people who are traveling or expats, like as a group, we're also kind of far-flung. So our office is in Brooklyn, but I work very closely with a woman named Annetta Black, and she's in San Francisco, and she handles a lot of our event stuff. Because one of the other things we do is we felt like it wasn't enough to just write about these places. We really wanted people to get out and experience these places. Because a lot of times I'm talking about some sort of exotic, you know, really crazy places, but there's a place a mile from you, wherever you are, there's some amazing thing like quite close. And so we try and, you know, we organize trips. We do this thing called Obscura Day, which is this giant one day a year. It's 100+ events all over the world. So hopefully something's happening, you know, near you.
I'm imagining like a huge Excel list on your computer with trying to coordinate all the details of 100 different events.
Insane. It's really that it like that's it's wild. So. Yeah, the spreadsheets get like absolutely out of control. Annette is in San Francisco. We work with a main writer who kind of manages the day-to-day of what's going up on the Atlas. She's in LA. Our developers here in Brooklyn. My co-founder Josh is in New Haven, Connecticut. So we're all over the place. The advantage of that, though, is we're able to run like events sort of ongoing in New York, San Francisco, and LA because we kind of have ground teams in each of these places.
So. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the events. I love that you really, it seems like in terms of like you founded your company, you moved really quickly into having like in-person events, which I think can be incredibly stressful to organize, but you guys have done them really well. How did you sort of move into that? And what were the first ones like that you did?
Well, so the first thing was Obscura Day, which I don't think we realized, you know, we thought, oh, this would be cool. Like we can kind of just call people up and organize with museums and, you know, collectors and get places that aren't normally open to the public to like open up and do a little sort of tour for folks. And it just sort of grew. I mean, as we started it just sort of grew and grew and grew. And then it went like way, like was much more successful. A lot more people showed interest and came out than I think we'd originally anticipated. So it was a big kind of signal to us that this was actually an amazing way to interact with people and that we wanted to do this again and we wanted to do it better. And so that was our first thing. And then more recently, in about the last year and a half, we've been doing these ongoing events. So in a few cities, mainly, like I said, San Francisco, LA, and New York, we have these kind of every week or every 2 weeks, we have something going on. So whether it's a trip to a museum's, you know, storage room or a tour of some cemetery, we try and keep getting people out to explore.
That's great. And how are you organized? I mean, are you reaching out to these people? Are organizations coming forward to you now, like hoping to be included?
A little bit of both. We have places that we reach out to, and there's always places where we're like, I would die to get in, and it's tough. There's a bunch of like infrastructural city stuff. There's something called Tunnel Number 3 in New York, which is like the largest public works project that's ever been done in New York. It's huge. It's been going on for 30 years. We haven't gotten in there, and we're not they're not going to let us down there. But yeah, so we reach out to some people. Sometimes organizations come to us, and then in each place we have sort of a mailing list, which you can sign up for online, of where you get a notification like, here's the next couple of weeks worth of weird events to go
here's
to.
Your weekly weird newsletter.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the field trip you did recently. I went on the Greenpoint one in Brooklyn, which was great. Tell us a little bit about how the field trip concept sort of came about.
So about 6 months ago, Google reached out to us, which is always a nice call to get. So they were putting together an app that had sort of similar aims as what the Atlas does, which was to basically let people find out about interesting things all around them. Now, they take a slightly sort of wider approach. So it's also like things about, if you're like a foodie, there's all of these different content providers they worked with who do stuff about food and architecture, history. But one thing that was really nice is they contacted, it's only about 20 content providers mm-hmm. now, but it's all like sort of really editorially high level stuff. So anyway, so they came to us, they asked us to be a part of this app. And then we thought, wouldn't it be awesome to do some events that use this app and got people out to actually explore, especially if it's a place that maybe they're familiar with or think they're mm-hmm. familiar with, and to show them that there's this whole other layer there, that building they've walked by for 2 years actually has this wild story and is full of kind of, you know, there's a whole, it changes the way they see their neighborhood. So that was the idea. So in New York, Boston, Minneapolis, Chicago, San Francisco, and LA, we did this simultaneous kind of exploration event that used, if you had the app, it was only for Droid. You used that. If not, there was a map and there were all these physical markers. So it was fun to also play with the digital, physical kind of connection.
I love that combination. I thought that was really fun. I had actually never done something like that. It was in Greenpoint. I live in Greenpoint. I figure I know this neighborhood. Like, no offense, but what are you going to show me that's new? And I loved it because it was great. I didn't know, for starters, that in Brooklyn there is a feral cat, what is it, community? Like a cat town? Was it called
yeah,
Cat Town?
Yeah.
I'd we'll like call it to be called Cat Town.
Feral Cat Village.
Feral Cat Village.
Cat Town is a nice, is the handy nickname.
Which was just literally at the end of my neighborhood and I didn't know existed. And it was just so fun to sort of like rewalk the streets that I walked every day of my life, but to see these like exciting, happy little banners with flags on them just popping out of buildings that you pass by to say like, hey, did you know there's a farm on top of this building? Did you know that they're filming Boardwalk Empire down here? I mean, just really interesting things that I think you really get to re-know your neighborhood, which is a really valuable gift to give people. I think especially in very large cities, because you kind of get stuck in a routine.
Yeah, and that's kind of our thesis statement of like the whole point of the Atlas is this idea that it's not just about sort of, you know, crazy faraway places, because I mean, and I think that's sort of the hook that we pull people in on, but then we, you know, sort of what we want to follow up and say is like, actually it's about sort of digging deep, knowing the context, and being willing to believe that there's discovery to be made all around you. And in fact, I think, you know, right, there's sort of this weird push and pull, because in the age of the internet, it can very much feel like what could possibly be there that hasn't been raked over a thousand mm-hmm. times. But it's funny, like in assuming that, you end up actually missing out on all of this stuff that is there and is totally amazing. And the flip side of that, obviously, is the internet makes something like this project possible.
Yes.
Where we can get all of this wonderful information. And I think, you know, I had some concerns at the start that, you know, is putting this stuff online going to somehow take something away from these places mm-hmm. or you know, harm them in some way. And one thing that's been really nice to see is, especially with the art projects and the small museums, you know, a lot of times they close they close because they sort of, people don't know they're there. They're sort of, you know, relegated to the margins. And by giving a little bit of sort of publicity, it can make the difference actually in knowing like, oh, that place is like worth preserving or saving. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't, you know, tear it down because it's actually got a great history. So that's been a really positive kind of element of running the Atlas.
That's great. Well, I'm going to ask you more about that. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Dylan from Atlas Obscura.
Hey.
Today's featured book is The Collected Home by Daryl Carter. In the new traditional, Daryl Carter laid out the principles of his widely recognized and beloved design aesthetic, which balances individual comfort with a subtle color palette to achieve serene and timeless style. Now, Daryl explores the essence of what brings a home to life, from textures to multi-purpose furniture to unexpected objects. The Collected Home again dazzles with gorgeous photographs of rooms and details and enlightening text about what makes a space both comfortable and extraordinary. Additionally, Daryl provides, for the first time ever, hands-on advice for approaching home design, such as defining short and long-term goals, from selecting an antique door knocker to planning the architectural elements of an addition. Lavishly illustrated and with lots of hardworking information, The Collected Home will be a must-have book for anyone desirous of a home that feels richly layered, full of character, comfortable, and unquestionably calm. The Collected Home by Daryl Carter is $45 and available wherever books are sold.
Hey, welcome back to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today I'm speaking with Dylan Thuris, co-founder of Atlas Obscura, a compendium of the world's wonders, curiosities, and esoterica, otherwise known as a really excellently curated travel site for interesting things across the globe. So before the break, we were talking about some of the in-person events you've had and the ways those have sort of brought the community together. I'd really love to talk a little bit more about the way that the Atlas has sort of affected those communities in these sort of far-off places. And do you think it's this influx of sort of new, I'm assuming kind of younger audience coming in? Like, how has that affected those communities? Have you been in touch with people in those places?
Yeah, I mean, so there's sort of, I guess, two sides to this. I mean, one thing I really like seeing is at our events, it's an interesting crowd because it's actually this huge, broad range of ages, of interests. But the thing that unites people, and you know, it's nice to see young people there. But weirdly, I'm also really excited to see, like, 60-year-olds there, you know, who are excited about the history, or maybe they're like interested in infrastructure. But so yeah, there it's, I think there's definitely something of coming of age with the internet where either you get jaded or you get really excited about the possibilities of discovery and exploring. So it's nice to see that. And then yeah, for some of the small museums, some of the places we get, it seems like by sort of giving them some exposure, they end up, you know, we end up in contact with the community, and so, you know, and then sometimes sort of being able to connect them with a local audience that they didn't have before, because people sometimes, you know, they've, right, they're 3 miles away, but they had no idea that this crazy, like, village built by an 80-year-old lady out of bottles has been there for, mm-hmm. for 50 years and, you know, is in need of love.
I'm dying to know how this has affected your personal travel. Do you take normal vacations? Is that even a possibility for you anymore? Or do you feel like this pressure to take an incredibly off-the-wall vacation?
We have to kind of, like, we have to limit ourselves. Or you know, both my wife and I can be very intense travelers. So when we went on our honeymoon to Southeast Asia, and we had to very actively be like, no, this is going to be like a normal. But then inevitably we end up, you know, like, we still ended up going to this crazy, like, taxidermy room in the university there. We kind of can't help ourselves. We love it too. So
have you ever taken a guide, like a guided tour that somebody else has given? Or do you feel
No, it's not. I mean, we, you know, there's plenty of normal things happening as well. I mean, you know, it's not all weird all the time. I think that'd be maybe too much. But
what are sort of the next places that are on your horizon, either for trips for Atlas or personal places that you'd like to go?
Oh, that's tough. I mean, I would love, I got to take a trip to South America about a little over a year ago, but it was sort of just the northern part of South America. And so I'd love to go to sort of Patagonia, southern South America. You know, I could list about, I mean, this is going to get boring because it's going to be just all of the places in the world. I think for the Atlas, you know, there's no one place. I'd love to get, I'd love to continue to develop our coverage in cities, actually, sort mm-hmm. of large U.S. cities, because I think having that really thorough coverage of a city is what starts to give people mm-hmm. the realization of just how much there is to discover and how amazing the place they live really is.
Well, it's a really great practical version of things. So I think a lot of people, if they think of like really interesting exotic trips like that, they immediately think like, I can't afford something like that. How can I afford to do that? But giving people options in their own cities or cities that are like just a short drive away is a really great sort of alternative to still having that sort of interesting outside of the box experience, but not completely breaking the bank to do it.
Yeah. And I think even if you're traveling to someplace very far away, travel in a way is also all about context. It's not just mm-hmm. about, you know, getting far, far away from where you live. It's about understanding sort of where you are and what you're seeing. And so even, you know, you can travel around the world and stay at identical hotels and sort of do very, you know, see the kind of things you've already seen and knew you would see. Mm-hmm. Or you can stay in your same city and go to places that you would never have taken yourself to if you're willing to sort of be slightly brave and go someplace interesting and unusual.
How do you encourage or convince people to be brave with travel when that can be a little intimidating? I think, I mean, all political stuff aside and like safety concerns, just people getting outside of their norms. Like I'm trying to imagine how I convince right. my parents to do something like this.
Yeah.
I have no idea how I do it.
Well, you take, you do the first trip with you, you go somewhere, you take them there. I mean, that's sort of what we're doing with the events is like, we feel like once you do it once, you're kind of like, this was actually really neat.
Yeah.
And I feel like, so, you know, I hopefully the site helps get people excited about these places. And, you know, yeah, basically getting people out once, I think, gives them the courage to know that they might be interested in a much broader, much weirder set of things than they might have thought about themselves.
Yeah, that are outside of like the Holiday Inn in the center right. of whatever town they're
exactly.
staying in.
Yeah, exactly.
So, are there any sort of parts or geographic parts of the world right now that you're most interested in or you'd really most like to expose people to?
Yeah, well, I mean, I can say that we're, in terms of like our coverage, I mean, I really want to know more about Asia and Africa because our coverage there is sort of thinner than it is, mm-hmm. you know, in the US and Europe. And so I'm curious. I'd love to do some like sort of large reconnaissance trips there and
yeah.
spend a few months sort of looking around. So that's kind of from that perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you grow up traveling a lot? How did you sort of get bitten by the travel bug so intensely?
No, I didn't grow up traveling a lot at all. What I did grow up doing is taking road trips around the Midwest, and the Midwest is weird. It's really weird. There's like Wisconsin, Minnesota. You know, there's all of these strange places. There's a place in Wisconsin called the House on the Rock, which might be one of the most amazing, weirdest places in the world. It was built as a kind of like architectural revenge against Frank Lloyd Wright by like a spurned admirer and wannabe student. And so Frank Lloyd Wright told him he wouldn't hire him to build a chicken coop. And this guy was like, I'm going to show you. So he built this crazy house with this giant cantilevered, you know, unsupported sort of pinnacle coming off of it, and then it just got built on and built on, and even after he stopped, his friend was sort of collecting these crazy other museums and just folding them into this place. So it takes like 6 hours to walk through. There is a sculpture of a sperm whale fighting a squid that's like as big as the Statue of Liberty inside this building. It's
oh my god,
amazing. It's like the world's largest carousel. Anyway, so I went there when I was like 12. I kind of like, to me, that's actually something clicked in my head. And I was like, if this is here, like what could pop? So I traveled with a friend in between high school and college. And that was my first like real travel experience. But I think it all goes back to those road trips and just seeing like how odd, you know, the Midwest really was.
Yeah. Do you have any tips for people who want to do trips like this and maybe can't afford them? Do you have any? I mean, you have to travel all the time. What are your sort of tricks of the trade for funding or making trips like this possible or more affordable?
Yeah, I mean, I think besides the sort of like standard, you know, stay in hostels, they're actually fine, or stay, you know, now you have these incredible, I mean, I think what's wonderful is this explosion of things like Airbnb, you know, VBRO.
Do you guys use that when you travel, or are you typically staying with friends or people you know through the research for the site?
It's a mix. It's a mix of all kinds of stuff. It's friends, it's Airbnb, it's hostels, it's whatever sort of works best for wherever we are. So, I mean, so that's sort of like, you know, standard. But I think more than anything, you know, you just have to sort of commit and say, like, okay, I'm going to set it up and I'm going to put $100 away a month. Yeah. And then, like, you'll look up and you'll be like, oh man, I actually like have enough to buy plane tickets to this place. And so it's just being willing to like kind of make that time and commit to it. I think that's the biggest thing. It's like, you know, I guess also we're poor because we spend all our money on travel. So I don't know. Poor. Yeah. So like there's some trade off there. But
yeah. Well, everyone values different things. It's totally fine. You've been to amazing places that I'm sure we can't even dream of. But you've been to amazing places. But I want to know, what are your sort of favorite amazing places stateside? Let's start with New York. If you were sort of bringing someone here who was an Atlas Obscura user, let's say they're from Europe and they're coming to Brooklyn for the first time, what are the interesting places that you are going to take them to?
Oh wow, okay. So if I was giving
a curated Brooklyn Dylan
yeah
guide.
Yeah, yeah, wow. All right, so well, there's a few places, and some of them well, one place, unfortunately we can't go in it, or at least I can't legally take this visitor in there. But there's a place called the Atlantic Avenue Tunnel, and they used to have tours, but it's, do you know,
I remember that it was outside of the Trader Joe's now, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Did you ever go down there?
No, I should have done it. I assumed those tours, once they started, would just keep going every year.
It was this weird thing where the guy running the tours had discovered it in the 1980s. Like, he had actually like done this sort of Indiana Jones style, like looking through old maps in the city borough hall, and like found the manhole entrance to this like long lost tunnel, but it's like 12 blocks long, and there's actually a whole half of it. It's got a big bulk wall in the middle, so there's half of it that has not been explored, and he thinks that there's actually like a train car in there, whatever. It's amazing. So the Department of Transportation kind of shut down the tours a couple years ago because I think it was always sort of in a slightly gray area. Anyway, but that's an amazing Brooklyn spot. There's a really fantastic outsider art house that's actually going to be gone soon. It's already gone, called Broken Angel in Bed-Stuy. It's an amazing place. You know, people stumble across it, and
I remember it from the Chris Rock show.
Yeah, exactly. It was in the movie with
the Fugees, wasn't it? The Fugees reunited and played in front of Broken Angel.
So those are two really good Brooklyn places. I mean, and then from a like you know, there's a ton of crazy, weird, interesting historical places. I mean, like a good in Greenpoint, when I was doing the research about Greenpoint, at the corner of Huron and Manhattan, there was the Great Greenpoint Sewer Explosion, which was like giant explosion in the 1950s. So, yeah, you're always surprised. But I mean, I think, I don't know, I'd also like a great city for weird is Philadelphia. They have some of the most amazing, weird, interesting, the Mutter Museum, which is a giant, incredible medical museum. They have Eastern State Penitentiary, which is this preserved prison from the 1830s. And it's beautiful. It's like this ruin that they've kind of kept in this state of ruin. And it's just,
and you can just go in?
Yeah. I mean, they run normal kind of like tours of that place. I mean, it's an official kind of, you know, spot, but it's really fantastic. And then there's a place there called the Wegener Free Institute, which is a natural history museum that was basically frozen in time in the 1890s. Like, they stopped like sort of doing anything for it, and there's kind of benign neglect, I guess. And then, you know, about 20 years ago, they sort of said, oh, this is actually sort of a museum of a museum.
Yes.
And they've kept it the same way. So
I love being able to visit. I think that's why everybody loves the Natural History Museum in New York so much, is because there are so many portions of it that feel completely untouched for decades, where it's a great way to sort of look at the way we used to catalog and display and educate people about things.
Yeah, it's a whole aesthetic world that you enter. And it's beautiful. I find natural history museums to be, I pretty much any city I'm in, I try and go to the Natural History Museum because I think they're a fascinating, beautiful kind of aesthetic from the past.
Mm-hmm. So what's coming up next for Atlas Obscura? What are the big projects you have on the horizon?
Well, we've got a relaunch happening any day now. It's a long...
our web design.
Yeah, right. Exactly. We're doing a full design overhaul. We've been working with the same kind of little site that we like scrapped together 3 years ago. So it's really exciting to basically be able to launch with an entirely rebuild thing. So I'm excited about that. And then Obscura Day is coming up. Actually, we don't have a fixed date for it yet, but sometime late April.
Okay.
That's sort of always when it is. So we got to figure out what weekend we want to do. You know, I think we're in the middle of working on our book, which is another big project. And it should be done probably by like 2027 or something. Like, yeah. No, I don't know. It'll probably be out in 2013 sometime, hopefully.
That's
but
great.
Yes, I'm really excited about that. It's been fun. It's fun to work on a physical product. You know, you spend a lot of time building things online, so having the kind of the idea that you're going to make something that I can give to someone and hold in my hand is really, really nice.
It's yeah. exciting. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing that in print. And for all of you who are just hearing about Atlas Obscura for the first time, you can visit atlasobscura.com for more information, to visit guides and sign up for the newsletter to find out about the next Obscura Day and read all of the fascinating guides that Dylan and all of his team have written. So thanks so much for being here, Dylan.
Thanks, Grace. It's been really
thanks.
Fun.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.